May it please the court, Mr. Downey. This court has held on more than one occasion that disbarment is the appropriate sanction when a lawyer with intent to deceive the court submits a false document or makes a false statement of fact or law. Based on the record in this case before the court, that is an accurate description of respondent's misconduct. Respondent filed pleadings in the Missouri Court of Appeals for the Southern District containing falsified notary attestations that had been copied and pasted onto the pleading and altered to reflect a different date of attestation. When the appellate court ordered respondent to explain the irregularity, she aggravated the lies to the court by falsely stating that the pleadings had in fact been properly notarized. As noted by this court in the Carancini case, misconduct of this nature is an affront to the fundamental and indispensable principle that a lawyer must always treat the tribunal with candor. In the absence of that candor, the legal system cannot properly function. The facts of this case illustrate that principle. In October 2015, a respondent filed a notice of appeal on behalf of her client in a case captioned Abston v. Bramer. In February 2016, the court dismissed the appeal due to the appellant's failure to take the necessary steps to perfect the appeal. The court thereafter granted respondent's motion to recall the mandate. However, respondent failed to take any further action on behalf of her client. As a result, in April 2016, the court ordered respondent to show cause why the case should not be dismissed for failure to perfect the appeal. On April 20, respondent filed a motion for extension of time to file the record and attached to that motion a notary attestation to the pleading that reflected that it was notarized in July 2015, even though the notice of appeal in the case was not even filed for months later until in October of 2015, an obvious falsity. The motion purported to be notarized by Amanda Gilbers, who was a legal assistant for another lawyer in the building where the respondent had her law office. Just 27 minutes later, respondent filed a second motion for extension in the case, identical to the first motion, except that the attestation date in the notary block had been altered to read April 2016 instead of July 2015. By filing her second motion, respondent obviously realized her deceit would be easily discovered by anyone performing even a cursory review of the first pleading. That deceit was indeed discovered by the attorney for the appellee, Ty Smith. Mr. Smith filed a notice of irregular documents with the Court of Appeals, and the court ordered the respondent to explain the irregularity. Respondent replied to the court's order by attempting to cover up her deceit. Instead of acknowledging that she had copied and pasted a false and altered notary attestation to the motions, she actively sought to continue her ruse and hide her misconduct by misrepresenting to the court that Ms. Gilbers had in fact notarized the motions and by purporting to attach a statement from Ms. Gilbers to her response. Ms. Gilbers ultimately gave a deposition in the case before the disciplinary hearing panel and testified that she never notarized the two motions, that respondent never discussed the two motions with her, and that she never provided respondent with any signed statement. Based on the reports from Mr. Smith and the Court of Appeals, the OCDC opened an investigation and sent respondent a series of four letters directing her to respond to the investigative documents. She failed to reply to four directives sent in May and June of 2016. In this case, informant charged respondent with four violations, 4-3.3A1 in that she made a false statement of material fact to the Court of Appeals, 4-8.4C in that she engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, 4-8.4D in that she engaged in conduct involving prejudice to the administration of justice, and 4-8.1C in that she failed to respond to the OCDC's directives regarding her conduct. The panel found all four of the charged violations and recommended that respondent be indefinitely suspended with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 6 months. Based on the current record before this court, informant concurs in that recommendation. The ABA standards, specifically standard 6.11, provides that disbarment is appropriate when a lawyer with intent to deceive the court makes a false statement or submits a false document and causes significant or potentially significant adverse effects on the legal proceeding. Standard 6.12 is the same standard except it involves knowing misconduct and recommends a suspension. Respondent's actions in this case were at least knowing and arguably intentional. One might argue that it was knowing misconduct to copy and paste false notarial attestations to the two motions However, her third pleading, where she actively deceived the court in response to the directive to explain the irregularity, seems to rise to the level of intentional deceit in violation of 6.11. A large part of this case comes down to aggravators and mitigators. The panel made no findings as to aggravators and mitigators that may be present in the case. However, there is evidence of both. In aggravation, there have been multiple offenses, and there's a dishonest motive on the part of the respondent. In mitigation, respondent has no disciplinary history. The main issue, I think, on this case is a respondent's attempt to rely on Rule 5.285 at the DHP hearing and before this court, stating or arguing that a respondent suffered from a mental disorder and was on medications at the time of the misconduct. As the court knows, Rule 5.285 permits the court to consider a mental disorder in mitigation, provided that explicit procedural and evidentiary requirements are met. Specifically, Section 5.285C provides that a mental disorder is not a mitigating factor in a disciplinary proceeding unless an independent, licensed mental health professional provides evidence that the mental disorder caused or had a direct and substantial relationship to the professional misconduct. The subsection goes on to point out that the rule, that very clearly point out that the respondent bears the burden that the mental disorder is a mitigating factor. Respondent failed to carry her burden under Rule 5.285. The primary witness on this issue was Dr. John McAllister, who practices in the area of pediatric anesthesiology. Significantly, he is also the respondent's father-in-law. He's not a licensed mental health professional, and he's not independent. Although he testified generally regarding the side effects of the medications that respondent was taking, he did not provide probative evidence of a mental disorder that had a direct and substantial relationship to the misconduct. In addition, no other independent licensed mental health professional provided such evidence.
What was the benefit she received by cut and pasting the notary attestation?
Judge Breckenridge, the respondent argues, or at least states in her brief, that the notary seals were unnecessary to the motions for extension. I have two responses to that. First of all, I think that procedural rule 55.03 requires that all e-filings must have a certificate verifying that the attorney signed the original. So verification and notaries are two different things, I believe, but nevertheless, she may have believed them to be the same. The Southern District Special Rule Number 3 requires that all motions to extend time to file the record be verified. So again, in her...
Oh, it saved her from going somewhere and getting a notary.
Well, I'm not sure what benefit there was, except that she felt that it had to be a notarized document, and so she found it, whatever reason, that she would cut and paste this notary.
My concern with that, though, is ABA Standard 6.12 talks about there being injury or potential injury. So how did that injure the other party?
Okay. Two points to that, Judge Powell. I think the injury is to the legal proceeding, the fact that you're misstating something to the court, even something that maybe is not necessarily required, although I think it is required. The other point I would make is that her client ends up, after the case is finally dismissed by the court, pro se filing a motion to set aside the dismissal, and that motion is denied by the Court of Appeals. So the client has certainly been harmed, and the ABA standard not only talks about harm to the legal proceeding, but harm to the client. So in this case, the client was harmed by the failure by the lies and the failure to perfect the appeal. Thirdly, I would argue that even if you put aside the two pleadings and state that they didn't require notary attestations, that third pleading rises to the level of active deceit on the court. The court has now asked, they've identified this irregularity, they've asked for an explanation, and she lies to them, just outright lies that this was, it was notarized, and I'm attaching or purporting to attach a statement from the notary.
None I agree that's happened. Egregious, but again, I just... That
well, in my view, that third pleading sets it aside from just knowledge. It's active intentional deceit, and now you've been asked to explain something, and you've lied to the court. So I think the harm to the legal system is palpable, even if you put aside the first two motions that simply had notaries that maybe arguably weren't verifications, arguably maybe weren't necessary, that third pleading, I think, just puts it right dead center on a 3.3A1, 8.4C violation. Respondent and her counsel argued at the hearing that somehow it was the informant's obligation to seek this independent examination by a licensed healthcare provider, that it would not have been proper for them to seek this independent review under 5.85C. Of course, that's exactly what the rule requires, that the burden is carried by the respondent, not by the informant. And that should be distinguished, for example, from the process that 5.285 speaks to when you're going through a reinstatement process. There, subsection E specifically requires that the applicant for reinstatement and the OCDC agree on an IME, who's going to perform it. But that's a whole different setting in which that occurs. In a case like this, that's an adversarial proceeding and information under Rule 5, it's logical and it makes perfect sense that 5.285C would require that burden be carried by the party who's trying to prove the mitigating factor. So I think that argument really falls as not being appropriate under the express provisions of the rule.
Counsel, can you tell us, under the idea of progressive discipline, why this is the floor, this is the starting point for this attorney? 6 months suspension?
Yes, sure. That she has no disciplinary history, right. Judge Draper. And you know, we've had this discussion before in other cases and other settings. In my view, progressive discipline applies when you have a history. This court is generally not going to impose the same or a lesser sanction on that attorney. That doesn't mean that the first violation in a case by an attorney with no disciplinary history may not be a suspension or even the most severe sanction of disbarment. In my view, progressive discipline doesn't apply when there is no disciplinary history and the attorney has done something serious enough to warrant a suspension on its face. And in this case, arguably, even something more severe than a suspension. So I think that progressive discipline, that theory and that the court clearly follows, is not really applicable to a situation even though she has no history. I would agree with that. I reserve the rest of my time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Pratzel. I'm going to start where many of the questions focused, which is the question of what harm was caused here. The electronic filing stamps on the two motions for extension indicate they were filed at 12 o'clock a.m. on April 20th and at 12:27 a.m. We know because of the sequence of filing, that means they were filed a few seconds after midnight on the 20th, and then they were filed about 27 minutes later on the same day. The interesting thing is, as Mr. Pratzel indicated, was the actual motion for extension, the response to the court order, was not actually due until a few seconds, the second before midnight, 48 hours later. So the question of could she have gotten a notary if she was right thinking, I think the answer is clearly yes. There also is a question of whether or not it needed to be notarized. The answer clearly is no. The local rule for the Southern District did require a verified pleading. As indicated, many pleadings are verified. There's actually a statute that is included, I believe, as Exhibit 7 in the file.
And that is an argument that goes to the first two filings, but not to the false statement that it was a correct and valid attestation.
You are correct. And just to finish, there's a statute, actually, 509.030, that states that where something needs to be verified, notarized, et cetera, simply a statement that it is stated under penalty of perjury satisfies the statutory requirement, which is sort of interesting. And just so you're aware, there's actually a federal statute that says if you use magic language, you don't have to notarize things. With regard to the third pleading, the first two pleadings, I think it's really critical for the court to look at them. It is an incredibly obvious cut-and-paste job. There's actually a line that goes across the page before the notary block. And on the second one, it's very clear that the notary block has been doctored. The original notary block was from 9 months before the document was filed. The second one was doctored to look like it was July of 2016, but it's pretty obvious it was doctored. The third filing, frankly, in reading it, as I described, and I had to actually look for the right word, it really is claptrap. It doesn't make any sense. It's not a logical document. And I think the interesting thing here is that obvious question of why in the world would she file it when it was so clear that it was going to be disproven. And I think that very quickly gets us into her mental condition, and I think that also gets us into this question of 5.285. But I think there's a critical stop on that way, and that is actually to go to Judge Powell's questions about the standards. There are standards that get into different levels of, you can call it scienter or mens rea with regard to misstatements. And Judge, you had asked about standard 6.12. I direct the court's attention, as we have in our brief, to standard 6.13 and 6.14. 6.13 states that where a misstatement is made negligently, that in fact the proper disciplinary sanction is a reprimand. 6.14 says that where there was an isolated incident where the statements are made false, whether or not the statements were false, and where it apparently caused no injury, that in fact a admonition is appropriate. And so I think it's important to realize the court doesn't have to look at the mental state only as mitigation. It actually has to look here at the standard of what penalty should be imposed.
Mr. Pratzel says her client was injured by her failing to properly file these documents.
There's absolutely no evidence of that in the record. I mean, we do know that the appeal was dismissed. There's no other evidence about any harm from the client. I believe there were actually two parallel proceedings going on, so I'm not sure if perhaps the other proceeding took care of the fact that this appeal was not perfected. It was a dispute over property.
But the fact that she lost her right to appeal, isn't that enough of an injury? Isn't that a tangible injury?
We would say, I mean, you could certainly consider that injury, and we would say that the discipline we're saying is appropriate, which would be a state suspension or less, would certainly recognize that injury.
But it was more than just neglect. I mean, Mr. Pratzel argues that this was a dishonest motive, that there were multiple offenses. These aggravating factors, don't they add up to more than an admonition and a state suspension?
And notice I'm not arguing admonition. I actually think the key case here, and it's actually the primary case cited by the informant and also our key case, is the Kriegel case. And I really think if you look at that case, it really does show why a state suspension is the appropriate penalty. And I should mention, by the way, our brief indicates that Hess was a state suspension. That is incorrect. Hess was actually a suspension. But I think Kriegel's really the controlling case here. In Kriegel, the attorney, as you may recall, it's a relatively recent case, was seeking to terminate parental rights for an adoption to go through. And he and his client adopted what was known as a passive system, where they answered questions technically correct but didn't, for example, inform the birth father, the child been born, et cetera. Interestingly enough, Kriegel, in that particular case, when you talk about injury, caused the birth father not to appear at the hearing for the termination of parental rights, caused the birth father to have to spend months of additional litigation fighting to get those rights back, and in addition, the attorney respondent never admitted he had did anything wrong. He actually took a very stern position of, I did nothing, did everything
and,
right.
And he presented testimony at during a hearing that gave the impression of false information.
Correct. They asked, you know, have you talked with the husband? Yes, or the father. And it was certainly suggested that the father was not interested when, in fact, the father had made clear that he did want to be hearing. Absolutely. And I think that's important to look at here in comparison, where here you have a young attorney. You have an attorney who you can certainly consider it multiple instances, but it is a period of a very short period of time. It's from April 20th of 2016 through the last pleading is actually filed on April 25th. And then we get into the extraordinary situation here of a woman who, just so the court understands, the severing of the brachial artery and the severing of the brachial plexus basically means that the artery that provides blood to her arm and hand was effectively almost cut off, and the plexus actually is everything that carries all the nerves for her arm and hand. So we're talking about someone who continues to this day to not really being able to use her dominant hand. You have extensive testimony, you have extensive evidence, the medical records are present, and we actually cite a letter from a Dr. Tung, who's a professor of surgery. It is almost the entire page 15 of my brief. And I think that Dr. Tung, who is not her father-in-law, makes very clear the devastating nature of the injury and also the incredible impact of the psychoactive drugs she was taking, which we also then have multiple people testifying saying she wouldn't return phone calls, she wouldn't leave her house, she lived in the dark. And in the midst of this incredible medical situation, we have these filings which, as the court has correctly suggested, just don't make sense. And we certainly believe discipline is appropriate. Ms. Limp has never contested that. In contrast to the Kriegel, when we filed our answer, we admitted it. Also, when we filed our answer, we made very clear in two affirmative defenses that we were going to raise the 5.285 issue.
Do you concede that you have not complied with the requirements of 5.285?
There was no independent medical examination. That is correct. So, and in fact, as I also indicate, and I believe that you can rule and you can provide Ms. Limp with a sanction we believe is appropriate simply on the facts and looking at Kriegel. I think that Limp is a better case for the respondent than Kriegel is, and Kriegel received a state suspension. So I think we can just decide it there. I think beyond that, though, I think that 5.285 doesn't fit this well, and I actually think more than that, I think that 5.285 does a disservice to the bar. And the reason I say that is that, first of all, if we were to ask an independent examiner, can you examine Ms. Limp in 2018 and tell whether or not the effects of these drugs she was taking in 2016 caused the misconduct, which the rule appears to require, it would be hard to imagine anyone could look at someone 2 years later and say, yes, or 18 months later and say, yes, I can draw that line. Ms. Limp had been off the medication for almost a year. The other thing about, so I think truly it would be almost impossible. And in fact, there's actually a reference, I believe, in Dr. Tung's letter about that. Dr. Tung was a treating physician, so he would have been caring for her at the time he actually performed the surgery. But he wouldn't qualify as an independent medical examiner. The next thing that I would say about this is that this rule, to my knowledge, is unique among all the jurisdictions. We've done research. We also asked on a listserv of respondents. No one is aware of a similar jurisdiction that has this requirement. I believe that the standard for mitigation of mental health that is set forth in the ABA standards, which is standard 9.32 and is also cited in my brief, is fully sufficient. I think it's fair to say that we want to be careful how it's used. I think the important thing also, though, is a hearing panel is very well positioned to decide, do we think this person really has a serious mental condition, or do we think this person is simply trying to excuse misconduct by saying, I wasn't feeling well that day? I don't think we need 5.285. I believe it was probably adopted, and Mr. Pratzel may know better, in response to the Bells case, or sort of in conjunction with the Bells case. I think there were a lot of other ways to deal with it, and I think it's a sad comment with where mental health problems are for the legal industry, the legal profession, that we have created this burden that says if you commit misconduct because of some mental health condition, it's not going to be considered unless you go through this process that, frankly, for a lot of the lawyers suffering mental health problems is a real burden. Many of them don't have a lot of resources. And in fact, I just had a hearing, which you could see happening here. If Ms. Limp hadn't talked about her mental health conditions, we would probably have someone asking the question, why did you file these notarizations 48 hours before the deadline with cut-and-pasted notarizations? And there's an obvious answer there, which is I was dealing with all these drugs, I was going without sleep, I was in incredible medical distress. But we're being told, well, that can't be considered. I had another case recently where they said, well, why didn't you take this action? The person said, I was depressed. And the response
don't
was,
you think there's some benefit in the court not just accepting documents that are medical documents and statements of medical experts that are presented on behalf of one party without seeking more objective information?
We frankly always expected in this case that we would get the request for an IME to be performed. To be honest, in my experience, usually an IME is done on a personal injury plaintiff and it's at the request of the defendant. We never received that response, and that was why we thought, okay, we've clearly raised the issue. They know it's going to be an issue. I jumped up and down three times in the affirmative defenses, and there was never a request made. So, and that's why I say, I mean, here we really did invite them to say, you need an IME, and if they had made that request, we were expecting that we were going to say, how about we use this person, and we would negotiate who that person was and provide whatever was required. And
couldn't you have called Mr. Pratzel and suggested that?
He actually was not the prosecutor, but yes, I certainly could have talked to Ms. Walker, who was the prosecutor. And she and I talked about a number of other things in the case, but never discussed at all the need for any sort of IME.
Now, if that IME had the information that's in your brief and in the findings from the commission, wouldn't that person have been able to make an opinion, a medical opinion, based on the information provided, even though it's 2 years later?
I would certainly hope so, but unfortunately, I'm not a medical examiner. I don't know.
Well, didn't you just tell the court that it would have been impossible for a physician to do that 2 years later?
The medical professional would be in the exact position this court is in, which is looking at the clear evidence of mental devastation and saying, gee, did that probably cause the lawyer to do something completely nonsensical 2 years earlier? I mean, I think that we're all intelligent enough to read. When you read Dr. Tung's letter and you say, okay, why did she 48 hours before the deadline cut and paste something on and then scribble over it? And there's a clear answer. She was not in her right mind. I mean, I think it's hard to reach any other conclusion. And just the final thing, and I think, frankly, that the informant does this very well in their brief. There's a Mr. Pratzel started talking about that Karen Cheney supports that there should be disbarment from his statements. Obviously, the court knows, and the Kriegel case says that really is reserved for the most extraordinary case. Here, I think we don't have that case. Again, I really ask the court to look at the documents that were filed. The opposing counsel, apparently with no investigation, immediately filed a notice of irregular documents. He knew there was a real problem. Obviously, that additional filing is a problem, although Ms. Limp has also testified, and we provided a screenshot of her computer showing she actually had prepared a different response but filed the wrong one. So again, we're sort of left with, why did you do it? And the answer is, she wasn't in her right mind. The case law, particularly Kriegel, supports this should be a case where no penalty greater than a state suspension should be handed down. I think that is a very appropriate response. If the court does need to go beyond that to look at 5.285 in mitigation, I think that the court should find there was certainly enough here to consider the mental health, but I do also think that the court should reconsider its rule. I think it's an area where we are unique in a way that I think is potentially harmful to people. And I really do believe that hearing panels, as they hear testimony of good character and decide what weight they should give that, or they hear testimony about whether or not the person had a great early experience in their legal practice and give weight to that, they can certainly look at letters from health providers or look at testimony from health providers and decide that. And certainly the rule can say, you know, if the informant requests an IME, there needs to be one performed, and that would be certainly appropriate. But I don't think in this case it would have added a whole lot to the record. With that, unless the panel has any other questions, thank you very much.
May it please the court. I find it curious that counsel acknowledges that he didn't follow 5.285 and then attacks the rule as somehow being an outlier. I just find that curious. I think that it's clear that 5.285 in any mitigation shouldn't be considered because the rule was not followed. To suggest that we had any obligation to get an IME simply flies in the face of subsection C. That burden is on the respondent, and that burden was not carried. The medical testimony that was provided by Dr. McAllister wasn't independent. It wasn't by a licensed healthcare provider. And Dr. McAllister essentially agreed. He didn't even inquire into the misconduct itself. He simply looked at the medications and said, this could make someone loopy. And it obviously made her loopy because he saw her not acting herself. What 5.285...
Counsel, may I interrupt, please? What is a licensed healthcare provider? Any MD, or does somebody have to be board certified? And can it be a LPN?
I would think it would be a doctor who has some sort of specialty in mental health care.
Is that stated anywhere, either in the rules or in case law?
Not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of, Judge Neal.
And an MD can prescribe psychotropic medicine without being board certified. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
That said, the rule also requires that the person be independent. And this was... Dr. McAllister was the respondent's father-in-law. I don't think he met that standard in having Dr. McAllister appear and testify at the hearing. The claim that it would be difficult for a doctor 2 years later to look back and say, yes, there's a causal link between this mental disorder and the misconduct, it happens all the time. There's no reason that a doctor couldn't go back, look at the medical records, talk to the person, and make that finding. And had they done so, we might have had a different view of the case, but that was not done. There have been cases where a respondent has provided us with independent mental health care professionals' opinion, and we agree with it and agree with a 5.285 mitigation. To take advantage of that situation in this situation without having followed the rules simply doesn't fly in the informant's view. Kriegel. This was a lot more serious than the Kriegel case. Kriegel, the attorney, was questioning the client in a way that was dishonest to the court, but in furtherance of the client's interest in terms of getting the adoption, the termination of parental rights granted. I might also point out, in this case, it was directly deceitful to the court, and I might also point out in the Kriegel case that at least some members of the court, I believe three, thought Mr. Kriegel should be disbarred. We're asking for a stay of indefinite suspension with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 6 months as the panel recommended. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.